This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
By the Book on BFM 89.9.
Hello, you're listening to By the Book, and I'm Sharmila Ganesan. Today we have for you something a little bit different. Late last year, my co-host Lee Chwilin and I moderated a virtual author discussion as part of a collaboration between Gerak Budaya Bookstore and the Georgetown Literary Festival. For this, we spoke to Singaporean writer Melissa De Silva about her book called Others Is Not a Race, which chronicles her experience as a person of Eurasian descent. Here is an edited version of that session. Lynn and I tremendously enjoyed reading your book, Others Is Not a Race. And just to set it up a little bit, I wanted to explain that it's not a sort of long story in that sense. It's vignettes of creative nonfiction drawn from various aspects of your identity of being a Singaporean of Eurasian descent, and explores the inherent problems with the Chinese, Malay, Indian, and others categorization. There's just something very, very relatable about the things you write about, and I think that's why they're so powerful. I have to tell you though that if there was one thing I came away, that the one overwhelming feeling after I read the book was this intense craving for Eurasian suji cake. I am going to start off by asking you where the best suji cake you've ever had is from.
From my mom's oven.
Nice.
I mean, the literal oven in the kitchen. Yeah. I think many Eurasians will say that, you know, their mom's suji cake is the best, or, you know, their aunties or grandmas. And I think it's very typical of many cultures, you know, people just swearing by their own mom's cooking. And you can't please them otherwise, no matter what you do. Yeah, so I'm sorry, I am biased like that.
That's fair. While we're on the topic of suji cake and curries and roast
Chinchalo.
And hunger and all the rest of it, I wanted to know, I mean, food plays a really large role in the book, either as a, I guess, a jumping off point for certain conversations, or a jumping off point sometimes for you to investigate your own relationships with the food, with the culture. Could you tell us a little bit more about that and what you found, you know, in the course of writing the book, of your relationship or the relationship between food, culture, and heritage?
Well, it was both interesting and funny how I stumbled onto the path of using food as an avenue to investigate and reclaim some of my Eurasian culture. It started because I knew that I had very little sort of like knowledge of my own Eurasian culture, and I was okay with this for a while. But it reached a low point one New Year's Day when I was at a party, a lunch party, and then my friend, who's also Eurasian, showed me a picture on her iPhone, and this was a picture of three dishes, and they were three Eurasian classic dishes. They were all brown foods on white plates. To me, they looked identical. And she was like, oh, yeah, so at my family gathering last night, we had this. Like, I'm sure you can name them. Then I thought, oh, my God. Like, not only, you know, there are no names even coming to my head. It's not like I can't match the names to which brown dish. No names were coming. And I was flabbergasted. And I think I quickly distracted her. And, you know, I avoided to answer the question. But, yes, it was comical, but I also felt very saddened by my own ignorance. And I must say that, you know, in my family, we only really ate traditional Eurasian cuisine at Christmas. Due to some other reasons, you know, most of the time my mother didn't cook Eurasian food. So it wasn't, you know, my top of the line recall. And but I thought, you know, this isn't really on. And I thought, you know, what if one day I have children and I can't even, you know, pass down any foods or names of foods, you know, this is really pathetic. So the food avenue, that was kind of the trigger of it. So then, you know, my mom has this recipe book, handwritten recipes like you have. And with all these wonderful Eurasian dishes, you know, like the debal curry, the feng, the vindaloo, everything. And I was like, you know what, I'm just going to try making as many of these as I can. And at that time, I had some food intolerances. So I was replacing certain ingredients like the meat with chickpeas, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is gonna just really make ancestors turn over in their graves and all that, but who cares, you know, like just do this. And you know, it turned out okay and was fun. And at that point I didn't think like, oh, I'm gonna like make this into a book or anything. I just try to be very conscious of what I was doing. And then I would like jot down notes later because I have a very bad memory and I knew I wouldn't be able to remember, you know, maybe like a year or two on what I'd done. And I wanted to, in case I forgot what I'd done, still have something I could show to, you know, maybe my children one day or something, like, okay, this is what I have of your culture. Take it now, you know? So that's why I documented things. And then I found the experiences so complex. They made me feel better, like, about, you know, okay, I have some culture, I'm trying to reclaim it. But I also was made very much aware of, like, the huge gaps, which I kind of felt some of these gaps I can't close. I can't reclaim some of this knowledge. I can't reclaim some of these traditions. And that was really difficult to be aware of and then accept. But so, yeah, it was very mixed. And, yeah, so I hope that answers that question.
It does. And, you know, that sense of wanting to reclaim something, that's a thread in the book that also relates to language, more specifically your idea or your attempt to reconnect with Kristang, the increasing loss of the language itself. And that's actually a pretty big part of the book. Can you tell me a little bit about that connection between language and race and identity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. I think, you know, in Singapore and similarly in Malaysia, in terms of this situation, you know, for instance, like, you know, Kristang or languages or dialects of certain very small communities and micro communities are not taught in national schools. So, you know, then it's left to the individual families to pass on, you know, these languages. But, you know, in Singapore, I think Malaysia maybe does much better at this in keeping various languages alive, and Chinese dialects are very much alive in Malaysia. I think in Singapore, it probably is less so, sadly. Yeah, so certainly I'll say it's my ancestral language, Kristang, and for those who are unfamiliar with it, this is a Creole language, and Creoles are languages which are comprised of two or more languages, and Kristang originated very organically in Malacca because of the Portuguese colonization, and it has a kind of basically a Malay grammatical structure, and it has lots of Portuguese vocabulary. So, like, you know, in Malay, if you want to pluralize something, you put the two words in a hyphen, right? Like, say somewhat. That's used in Kristang, but the word for somewhat will be, say, like, the Portuguese word for it. Yeah, which I don't know what the name of N is in Portuguese. But anyway, so yeah, so that is Kristang. And my grandmother spoke it. And I lived with her until I was 5. And so I was hearing it, but no one was actively teaching me this language. I mean, I think that's quite natural in most cases for most people. So when my grandmother passed on, I had not made any attempt to learn this language. I was not really interested in it. It seemed very irrelevant to me. And yes, this was, of course, a great foolishness on my part, absolutely. I can't explain the foolishness, but there it is. Anyway, so when she passed on, then suddenly I had this epiphany that, oh my God, you know, like, a huge part of my cultural heritage is now just lost forever. It's kind of too late. So I didn't embark on this quite ridiculous project of trying to learn Kristang from a dictionary and, you know, labeling things. That didn't work. Although the story in which I documented this, called The Gift, has a happy ending in which I succeeded. That ending is fictional, and I could not bear to document my failure. I really could not. And I didn't intend to publish that story, so I was like, no, I'll just write it as, you know, happy ending. So, yeah. But then, much to my surprise, years later, this brilliant university student in Singapore by the name of Kevin Martins Wong, who was a linguistics student, his mom is Eurasian. So he discovered that, you know, his great-grandmother spoke it and began investigating. And so he focused on Kristang as his, I think it was his thesis project. Sorry if I'm making a mistake, Kevin. Yeah, and, you know, he was just so amazing. He began teaching this to his friends, just like, you know, 5 or 6 friends who come off to his house. And then It just grew quite organically, and it became, you know, 12 people. And then now it is a very structured system of classes that you can sign up for online. And they're going to be introducing their first online classes because of COVID, of course, in, I think, January next year. And he even won like an award from our president in Singapore for his efforts. And he does all this, you know, with no, it's not a profit. Yeah, there's no payment, it's all free. So anyways, I was so fortunate to join those classes. And then I learned some of my own ancestral language. Yeah, and it ties back to community, you know, and like what your question was, Shamila. It was very strange to go for these Kristang classes for me. Because I know very few Eurasians. I know my family. I know our relatives. And then, like, I know about 5 girls from the convent where I went for primary and secondary school who are also Eurasians who studied Malay as a second language. So these are about all the Eurasians I know in Singapore. It's very strange. So when I went for these classes for the first time, I was seeing all these other Eurasian people, you know, and then I was like, oh my God, like, all these women speak like my aunties and all these men speak like my uncles. Like, all the men were like kind of corny, affable jokers. And then all the women were like quite fiery and, you know, don't mess with them. And, oh my gosh, like there are archetypes. Like, we are, you know, we have archetypes in our community and we have all these similarities that, you know, are recognizable. And the thing is, I know it may seem very strange to, I think, most of you, because I don't think any of your communities are as small as mine, but so I'm, you know, it's not often mirrored to me, like other people who are of my community. So I never knew that we actually share traits which are similar. Like, why? We don't know them. What is the reason? I mean, of course I have ideas why, but so it was just, it was a bewildering experience, but it was a good one. It was very, reinforcing for my sense of cultural identity.
You're listening to an edited version of an author discussion featuring Singaporean writer Melissa De Silva, author of Others Is Not a Race. This conversation was organized by Gerak Budaya Bookstore as part of the Georgetown Literary Festival. Stay tuned for the rest after the break on By the Book, BFM 89.9.
Bombing frustrated minds, BFM 89.9.
Welcome back. You're listening to Buy the Book with Sharmila and Lynn. And this is an edited version of an author discussion that we moderated late last year. It features Singaporean writer Melissa De Silva, author of Others Is Not a Race. The event was part of an online series organized by Gerak Budaya Bookstore as part of the Georgetown Literary Festival.
One thing that I found really interesting, and I think this is regardless of where you may be from, whether you are, you know, a person of Eurasian descent, whether you're Singaporean, whether you're Malaysian, I do think that a lot of us have grown somewhat distant from our cultural heritage in many ways. What you're describing, you're right in saying that, you know, not all our communities are as small, but absolutely this issue of maybe not speaking mother tongue, maybe not being so familiar with the food. How did you, I guess, was that difficult to write about, you know, as somebody who was in that process of discovery? And how did you kind of make it both so personal as well as very universal?
You know, Trillian, it's exactly as you say, you know, how you've described it, that it is sadly a rather universal experience, you know, this kind of disconnect from our traditional culture, our heritage for most of us who are living, you know, urban lives. I think whatever I was documenting and whatever I was experiencing was as much about reclamation as it was about loss. As much as I was reclaiming, I was also equally realizing there was so much that I had lost and that I cannot reclaim, you know. And it was, yeah, a lot of it was very painful to realize. But I thought, you know, I just have to push through. And, you know, none of us are actually static and things are always in motion. And I thought, well, you know, maybe I am collecting new things. Maybe I am going to pass on new things. And it's not just attrition only. It's not just net loss. I don't know if there's net gain. I don't know what it will be, you know, many years from now. But I just kind of like thought, no, I did feel kind of discouraged at some points when I just was like facing this whole expanse of like, oh, we used to know all these things. We used to do all these things. We don't do them. We don't know them. And we don't even know how much we don't know. And we don't even know how much we've lost, which I thought was even more tragic. But at the same time, I thought, well, I'm not going to make it worse by like, you know, just giving up and not like investigating further. So I guess that's really the reason why I pressed on.
You know, this all of these themes that you're talking about, I know that you did say that when you came to Malacca, you felt a sense of belonging and a sense of sort of finding something. But in a larger sense, this struggle with identity and race, it's something that is that people in Malaysia talk about all the time too, perhaps in different ways or different contexts. I was curious what the response has been to your book from readers in Singapore versus readers from Malaysia. And
because
perhaps
we can
even,
never resist the
yes,
Singapore versus
I know.
Malaysia comparison.
and also maybe people from outside of these two countries.
Yeah. Well, Shamila, I find it really interesting. Like, you know, and again, it's like how Trillian described earlier, that is, it is so universal. So at one event, this lady who's a Hungarian American, first generation, she said, yeah, you know, it's the same. My mom cooks wonderful Hungarian food. My parents speak, of course, perfect Hungarian. My Hungarian is terrible. I only know a few dishes and I cook them badly. So she identified. And I think it's just so common, you know, to experience loss, especially for any of us who are living in multicultural societies, who are living in very metropolitan kind of environments. But then, you know, I have been really so thrilled to hear from people just like this Hungarian lady who then said, you know, but after hearing what you did, like, I feel very inspired to, like, go and, like, you know, find my mother's recipes and cook them and learn more Hungarian. And so I find this very surprising and gratifying. And it's, well, I don't know. Unfortunately, I haven't heard personally from any Malaysians as to whether they went off to, you know, discover more of their dishes and languages, etc. I would love to. I do know of some Malaysians who are Eurasian who, I think they did take the book quite to heart, and it was deeply humbling, and I think they could relate to many things, as you said, you know, that all these complex feelings about identity and belonging, cultural identity, ethnic identity, and where does one fit in a national landscape, especially in a very multicultural landscape, you know, like Malaysia, like Singapore. I can't give you too many details about the Malaysians, unfortunately, because I don't have them.
So more Malaysians clearly need to read this book and get back to Melissa.
Yes, please do.
And, you know, something that I wanted to bring up is the fact that your family features very strongly through the book. I mean, even in our chat today, you've mentioned your grandma, your aunties, your uncles. And I wanted to also point out that within the book are two separate chapters that are really recordings of conversations, in some cases, a recipe of sorts, you know, from your family. And I wanted to talk about how your family and your upbringing shaped who you are and what it was like recording those conversations.
So, Julian, you're referring to my mom's recollection growing up, right? And my dad,
yes,
the recipes about the chinchalok, right?
Which sounded really good. I don't know if I have the patience.
I kind of want to make the chinchalok. The belacan, however, sounds tough.
Yeah, I think in Malaysia, y'all may have access to the shrimp. So my dad ended sadly saying, oh, you can't find this in Singapore. You can't find the shrimp in Singapore. And I was all like, well, there goes that. But I think in Malaysia, you guys can get your hands on the shrimp and try making the chinchalok. I mean, I'd heard like my mom's story of, you know, growing up in wherever she grew up in, you know, with her many siblings. And, you know, I'd heard that story of like, you know, the one sibling like sort of being stranded on the pole across the reservoir. I thought it was hilarious. But I think, you know, I'm very forgetful. So I think, you know, actually to sit down with my notepad and really record everything and then go back to her, and then, you know, read it out and say, you know, have I missed anything? Like, what should we add? you know, what other descriptions do you remember? I think it was not only very important for me, but I think, you know, it was, I think, also important for her. It made very concrete, like, this one memory that she had of her childhood, you know? And I think just as a family, like, you know, you have this one memory, like, you know, and then one fine day when everyone's memory is, like, gone to oblivion, you have this thing, you know? You have this thing. Yeah. And I think for my dad, it was really interesting because I'd never heard him, like, talk about these recipes before. I had no idea. He just reeled them off. He reeled off all the measurements, you know, oh, 1 teaspoon of brandy, this and that, how much salt. And I was so astounded. My goodness, he remembers these measurements of salt and brandy and the amount of shrimp that his grandfather taught him when he was a boy. You know, that's insane. Yeah, so, and I felt a strong and a new sense of, like, connection back to, like, you know, his past, like, to his grandfather. Like, to, I mean, of course, I don't know his grandfather. Yeah, so it was a really, it was a powerful thing, I think, for me, and I hope for them.
Melissa, I wanted to get into the question of form, or the form that the book itself takes, because it's largely grouped as creative nonfiction. Although one can argue that one particular story in it is maybe more speculative fiction, sci-fi, but I don't want to give too much away. What interested you in wanting to use this particular form? You know, why did creative nonfiction come so naturally to these themes?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, Shamila. Prior to this, I was trying to work on something which kind of also captured what it was like being Eurasian in Singapore. It was not a personal perspective. And as I was trying to, you know, work through that project, I realized that this was almost an impossible task because our community is so diverse and our ancestries are so different. Even one family to another, no family is the same ancestry in our community. So I thought, you know, whatever I try to capture or express is going to be inadequate and a dilution of our experience. And then also the other problem I thought of was that, you know, given the diversity and the breadth of our experience and our histories, etc., who am I then to try and be a voice for it? I could never, you know, and I don't feel like it would be appropriate for me to do so. So I put that project aside. I didn't really know how to solve all those problems. But I felt that it was important to express these things just in general, because I had always been troubled by them since I was a child. And I kind of just wanted to work through my own, like, troubled thoughts about all these things. Yeah, so then the first story that kind of knit this whole project together that I wrote was the first story of the book, which is titled The Gift. And that was a story that kind of, it documented the passing of my grandmother, my mom's mother, the one I grew up with until I was 5, who spoke Krista. So I just began writing that, and it was a very natural, instinctive process. I didn't think, I'm going to publish this as a story, then it's going to be about, not at all. I just wanted to kind of, like, work through this difficult experience. Hence, I, you know, added in a fictional ending without giving thought to, like, what is this going to be categorized as? You know, like, it didn't matter at that time. Yeah, so then after that, I realized that, okay, so at that point, I had some very small blog, and then I uploaded the story onto the blog, and I was very shocked because, like, yeah, people were like, oh, this is very interesting. We didn't know all these things about Eurasian culture and all that. Then I was like, oh, okay. So they're like, oh, please, oh, why do you write more about your grandma? I was like, oh, okay, this is quite surprising. Yeah, so I was also, you know, at that time shamed into finding out more about my culture. So, and documenting it. So I thought, well, okay, lah, I'll just, like, upload some of these pieces. And, you know, eventually some of them got accepted for publication in literary journals. But, of course, the readership is very tangy. And then I thought, well, it would be nice if more people can know about some of our Eurasian culture. So in the end, I had enough to submit it as a manuscript to a publisher in Singapore called Math Paper Press. So Kenny Leck, who's the publisher there, was really very kind and generous. And yeah, he accepted it for publication.
So you said that in some ways, you know, the writing began as a way for you to work through some of the things that were troubling you, some of the things you were curious about. How did the process of writing the book change or affect your relationship with your heritage, really?
Yeah, I think, Trillian, I've always had a really strange relationship with my heritage. Like when I was, say, in primary school, secondary school, I never sort of like felt Eurasian. Like I didn't know what I was. You know, I knew this was the name of what I was, but I didn't know what that meant. And I really didn't feel like I embodied it, whatever it was. So in secondary school, for example, I went through this phase where I really wanted to study Spanish and I wanted to like be a Spanish person. I don't know why, but it seemed like some kind of concrete cultural identity. I know it all sounds very strange. I can't explain it. But I think it just was a reflection of how there was a huge vacuum, you know, that I was trying to fill. And I think after, you know, going through all these like experiences of attempts at cultural reclamation, I felt quite naturally like a Eurasian. Like I knew about certain things, like if people asked me certain questions, I could actually answer them, you know, rather decently. And I think learning the language was really instrumental in me feeling Eurasian. I think that was really the bedrock, you know, language as that real repository of our culture, of traditions, of our value system as a large group of people who do and believe in some of the same things. Yeah, so I think it kind of, it really sort of like, it kind of brought everything together. Like it gave me a spine, like a cultural spine. Like before I felt like, now that I'm thinking of this metaphor for the first time, like, I was like a jellyfish, you know? And then after that, I had a spine, I could stand upright.
And I suppose that follows up, and this is tied to the question I asked earlier, I think, about this idea of how for many urbanites and heritage, I think that what you just described is something that echo with many people, certainly something that I feel. Do you think that a relationship with heritage and culture is one of practice? Because that's what language is and that's what cooking is, right? In many ways, it is a practice, sometimes daily, sometimes a special occasion, but the point is a practice. And I guess, have you found that and how has that kind of infused into your daily life?
Yeah, I absolutely agree that it has to be a practice. It has to be lived. Well, cooking is there sometimes. The language less so. When I was in the Kristang classes, it was easy because I had a group of people to speak Kristang with, like every week, once a week at least. So now that I'm not attending classes anymore, you know, I don't have that pool of people with which to exchange, you know, certain words. And one forgets these words very easily, you know, they're just in the short-term memory because when it's unlike the second language that we study in school, you know, you study them for, you know, 6-10 years. But, you know, these are very short-term memory sort of words for me at least. So even though I sort of advanced to the advanced level of the Kristang classes, it's terrible to say this, but most of it is kind of gone from my mind. Although I have the notes, you know. and honestly, I don't actually know what to do about it. I know that, yes, I can meet up with my friends from the class or, you know, have virtual meetings now with COVID. But it's difficult, you know, and it's really kind of inevitable that we will lapse into English because all of us are in the same boat of like having forgotten many, many words. And all of us will just say very simple things like hello and how are you and have you eaten? Then where do we go from there? I know this sounds quite depressing, but so at this point, I'm trying to think of other things that I can do that let me have contact with the language, despite not having a, you know, like a family or like, you know, neighbors whom I can speak it with, you know. But I'm still thinking about these solutions and what they might be. I'm sorry, I don't have a more uplifting answer for you.
I really love that answer, partly because I think in many ways it also captures the experience of reading about these same things in the book, which is there is a lot of joy. And this was something you read earlier as well. There is a lot of joy and there is also a sense of loss. And I think the book kind of balances that out.
A sense of guilt is something that I often feel, that I'm not doing enough sometimes. And I sort of, that's why I identified so much with what you were saying in the book, because you always feel like, maybe I should learn more. Maybe I should try more. But then there's also real life and all the other things you have to do. But one thing I realized, or that struck me about being Eurasian in particular, is that it is a culture of hybridity. It comes from these movements and changes. So there's an inherent contradiction in the idea of preserving something that in itself was made of change and mixture. Does that complicate your sense of what you're trying to hold on to, or how to hold on to it, how much to hold on to?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question, Shabala. I think what it does for me is that it adds this very strong tint of poignancy to whatever I try to do or think I should try to do. And when I think about, you know, the future of our community in general, because it is a community that was born just at a specific time of history, during the time of European colonialization of Asia. And, we did go through after that an era in which, we intermarried, among the community. No, sorry, we didn't intermarry. We married among the community. But then with time, of course, yes, our community is getting very, very diluted. And this is okay. But at the same time, when more cultures come into the mix, then our own culture, I feel, tends to get less strong. I'm just a wonderful case in point. So I do acknowledge that definitely there will come a time where we'll just die out. And there will be so few of us, you know. And I think... so that kind of prompted me to write the last story of the book, which is that speculative piece you mentioned, you know. So I just imagined what it would be like where there were only two Singaporeans left in Singapore who are Eurasian, and they only discover each other when the population census news is announced. And they're both men. They're not going to procreate, even if they wanted to. You know, and I mean, yeah, I know that one day will happen. It may not happen so dramatically or so soon. But then, you know, sometimes I just tell myself, it's okay. I'll be dead. I'll be long dead then. It won't matter, you know. But it does matter to me a little. But I do feel much less, I feel much less sad about it now. Than when I wrote that story. When I wrote the story, I was very, very sad. So I'm happy that I'm less sad.
it's a sad story in the way that science fiction that tends to be more, not nostalgic, elegiac, it's such a grand word, but that's what it means, this sense of mourning or loss, a feeling of loss. It is a very sad story. And it felt like a good ending to the book as well.
Thank you. I'm glad you thought so.
On a purely superficial level, I really enjoyed the animals in that book. I don't want to necessarily say how they appear, but they do, and it's a fantastic way to have that element in the story. So one thing that I did want to look at is the fact that I think so many of the discussions we have, even locally, about race and identity are informed by a Western lens. It's the language that we use, the phraseology, even the way we think about it. But your stories are so local, and they touch on something that I think so many of us have felt when faced with a form and, you know, asked to identify yourself in this very narrow way. In the process of putting this book together, of researching it, of writing it, have you been able to, I guess, hone in or create an approach that suits this region's history and context better in terms of how we could think about these things?
Well,
it's a large question, I grant you.
I don't think it's within my power to, create any framework on how we approach this in our region. I mean, I would love to have a panel too, but I don't, unfortunately. I think the only thing that I can hope to do is, you know, just to, through the book, hopefully, just invite people to think about these things a little, just a little or a little more. That's all I can do. And I think that is really the only thing I can do as a writer. Like, I'm not a policymaker. I'm not a politician. I'm not a legislator. And I am honestly not interested in being those things. I'm not by it that way. The only thing I can do is to try and invite people into other people's shoes and invite people to try and experience some of the feelings and thoughts of other people, you know, and kind of like have a taste of their experiences and what that might mean, right, as a fellow human being. And I think it's a great privilege to do it. And I think sometimes it's kind of, I feel very lucky, like just by expressing something, which I just feel quite, in a quite raw way, that, I mean, I don't think I have to, in some sense, like do too much, like, and then someone else can understand, you know. I don't think I'm really articulating this very well, but I'll give an example. So like, say for like the title piece, which is Others Is Not a Race, like I wrote that, because I was feeling very, very, very angry. And I was very, very angry at just being shunted into this category called others. And I felt and still feel that it's very demeaning. And, you know, people who are more practical minded have told me, don't take it to heart. Like, it's just a bureaucratic thing. It's just for administrative convenience. And I understand all that. But yes, like, there are other ways, I think, that these things can be organized and named. And, you know, so I have a great many objections to these things. And so I wrote that piece feeling really, I was incensed. And I just sort of actually kind of dashed it off. And then I didn't know whether to include it, because I think especially in Singapore, like the general kind of landscape, the public landscape is very sensitized to discussions about race. And I think sometimes over here we're not at the level of maturity yet to discuss race in certain ways. So I was a little hesitant about like including that piece. But then I felt that that is really also a very important facet of how I feel and my experience as a Eurasian. Like, I feel really invisible in Singapore. Like, I don't even have a name nationally. You know, that is why so many people, like other Singaporeans, like before Joseph Schooling, who is a Singaporean who won the, you know, the swimming Olympics, who's Eurasian, like before him, I mean, thank goodness for him, but you know, before him, then like most people had no reference, they had no clue. So I just felt that this shouldn't be, you know, I mean, we are your compatriots. How come you don't know? You know, I know about all of you. I know it's also a numbers thing, but still I felt like, no, this doesn't quite add up. So anyways, in the end, I made the decision, like, never mind, I will submit it, like, in the manuscript. And Kenny thought it was fine. And I said, but, you know, it's quite, like, I mean, it's very, I mean, it's kind of political. It's very confrontational. But he said, I'm okay with it. So I was like, okay, good. So, yeah, so yes. And I also decided that it would be the title of the book. Yes.
It's a great title. And actually, I believe it was in that piece that you had a particular line that really resonated with me. I tend to write down sentences that strike me in books. And I'm probably not quoting it right, but the spirit of it was that naming something makes them significant. And the power of that, and or rather the lack of power when that's not done. And I think that really encapsulates what you're talking about. But on that note of talking to your publisher and sort of working out what can be said and not, I was curious about what's next for you. You know, has this project sparked off new ideas, or are you doing something completely different?
Well, I have written another manuscript for a novel. I'm hoping it'll be published soon. So that is very different. It's a historical novel. it's set in Singapore in 1906 during British colonial time, of course. But that also is about, it's about race and identity and culture. And a lot of it is also set in, well, it wasn't Malaysia then, it was Malaya, in Malacca. So the protagonist is originally from Malacca. So she's a young woman who is, well, she's mixed, and there's some subterfuge involved with her presentation of her identity, because, yes, of the European sort of dominance of the day. And so she's pretending to be of an ethnicity she's not. And so it's about what kind of tensions and intrigues and stakes occur as a result of this.
That was an edited version of a conversation we had with Singaporean writer Melissa De Silva, author of Others Is Not a Race, where she talks about her experiences growing up as a Eurasian in Singapore. The session was part of an online series organized by Gerak Budaya Bookstore as part of the Georgetown Literary Festival. If you've read the book or have other similar book suggestions to share, you can tweet us at BFM Radio, WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, or write to us at buythebook@bfm.my.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.